Good morning, Dr. Moore. We're so glad to have you on to share some of your expertise about fragility fractures. First, I just want to welcome you to Asheville and to Mission Health Partners. I understand that you originally from Roanoke, Virginia, and that you're a lover of the outdoors. So it sounds like you're glad to be here in Asheville.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so not only are you a hand surgeon, but it sounds like you have trained in the entire upper extremity deliberately. So you're also trained in the shoulder and elbow. And just tell us a little bit about where you're situated and what your interests are clinically here.
Yeah, thanks for that introduction, Caroline. So I'm from Roanoke, Virginia, so not too far north of here. It's good to have remained in the mountains of the Mid-Atlantic. I did orthopedic training with a subspecialty in hand surgery, but my fellowship, we also did shoulder and elbow surgery. And I did that intentionally because I like wearing lots of different hats and I like variety. And I find that, you know, not just doing hand surgery, but also doing elbow and shoulder, I get to work on big joints and small joints. And I find that kind of variety and challenge to be really rewarding. You know, clinically, I try and keep my practice as open as possible, but I do kind of focus on the upper extremity.
Awesome. Well, great. So we are here today to learn a little bit about fragility fractures, which I understand has a really wide scope all around the world, but really specifically in North America and in Europe. So please tell us, what is a fragility fracture?
Yeah. So just real quick before we get into that, I thought this would be a great topic because it's truly multidisciplinary. It touches all of us at some point during our lives, whether us personally or somebody that we know. It's extremely common, and it's probably something that is undertreated in this country. A fragility fracture is a fracture that occurs as a result of generally the loss of bone mineral density that occurs with older age, although there are other reasons that we can have poor bone mineral density. I think of it as, you know, as an orthopedic surgeon, you know, we look at the bones as, you know, almost like wood. You know, we're carpenters. And so, you know, just the quality of that wood. As we get older and the bone mineral density goes down, that wood becomes less like a 2x4 and more like styrofoam. And so low energy falls, you know, things that would not typically cause fractures can actually lead to fracture.
Yeah, I see this a lot as palliative care doctor. And I'm often explaining it to folks as we age, our calcium leaves our bones and it goes into our blood vessels and other places that it's not wanted. And because people are often, you know, really thinking, what did I do wrong? How did I fall? How did I leave my loved one very long and this horrible thing happened? And it's not a matter of anybody's fault necessarily. Of course, we'll talk a little bit about risk factors and how to prevent, but it sounds like it's just a matter of aging. It's just the human condition and fragility and what happens to bone. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, age is for sure the biggest contributor over time. It's not, I think one of the common misconceptions about fragility fractures is that, you know, it's your bones, the quality isn't as high, but it's not the quality, it's just the quantity of that calcium, that mineral structure that provides the support and the strength of the bone. It just starts going down over time. And one of the shocking things about this is that that starts at about 30 years old. You know, that's kind of when we have that peak. And then all of a sudden, from then on, you're slowly losing bone mineral density, which will, once we get into kind of talking more about prevention, you know, I think once you understand that, you know, to really have a positive impact, sometimes you have to, you know, consider interventions that might start much earlier in life. You know, age, obviously, the things that can lead to a fragility fracture low bone mineral density. There are things that we do have control over and things that we don't. And so those are the modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. The things that we don't have control over are gender or sex or age, you know, our genetics. And then the things that we do have control over would be things like smoking, alcohol use, exercise, diet, you know, our weight, any medications that we might be taking. And so even though one of the big contributors is age and sex, you know, there's plenty of things that we can do to help, you know, decrease that rate of loss of bone mineral density that starts at about age 30. The biggest ones are probably smoking, alcohol use, and exercise. Smoking, I mean, you know, it's terrible for pretty much everything as far as, you know, health outcomes. And so I know that we're always trying to get our patients to quit smoking. Alcohol use, you know, moderating your alcohol use has a significant impact. But for me personally, the one that I talk to young people about, and I'm constantly bringing this up, is exercise. In orthopedics, there's a well-known principle called Wolf's Law, and it's basically bone grows proportional to the stress that it's put under. And so if you are doing lots of exercise, especially moderate to heavy weightlifting, then actually you're stimulating bone growth. There are mechanical receptors that feel that stress. And in response, your body tries to reinforce the bone where that stress is put in. And so, you know, starting at age 30, doing some sort of weight training program will help maintain the bone mineral density that you have to decrease that rate of loss. And that goes into, you know, people in their 40s, 50s, 60s. And so I know, you know, moving past the, you know, middle age cohort, you know, into our patients who are more at risk, you know, women over the age of 65 specifically, you know, having some sort of weight training program signals the bone to stimulate growth. And that's probably the one that I focus most on when talking to the people.
I saw that one of the things that we're looking at in terms of our physical exam is kyphosis. Is that just a marker of overall bone loss or calcium loss? Or are there things that we can do to particularly focus our most fragile areas where we tend to have these really morbid fractures?
Yeah, so I'm not aware of any long-term study that's looked at, you know, weight training. So I can't really cite that specifically. I think it gets broken out more into, you know, exercise, generally speaking. And there for sure are multiple papers that I've read that show that, you know, moderate to high level activity is associated with less hip fractures. And I would think that the same would be true for other, you know, types of fragility fractures, such as, you know, compression fractures in the spine, distal radius fractures. Because probably the people who are, you know, doing, you know, 120 to 300 minutes of, you know, moderate physical activity are going to be the ones who are going to be not just walking, but doing weight training. I think that there's been some association with activities that promote balance. So, you know, things like yoga, even though not weight training, they help, you know, prevent people from falling. You mentioned, you know, in the clinic looking for things like kyphosis, you know, over as you age, you know, the bones aren't the only things that start to break down. The vertebral discs, which are basically like water balloons that exist between the bones and our spine, they start to desiccate, and you know, you lose the water that was in there. They become more compact because you lose that water. They become more fibrotic, and so that can lead to the kyphosis. But sometimes that kyphosis that you see are, you know, the sequela of vertebral compression fractures that, you know, were small and not particularly symptomatic. And so I wonder if, you know, those are in the scores because, you know, these are people who have had, you know, small micro fractures in their spine that just, you know, wasn't clinically significant.
How are we iatrogenically causing or increasing risk for fragility fractures? So, you know, glucocorticoids,
yep.
That's big. But, you know, I think there's There are PPIs and, anticonvulsants and, even SSRIs. What are these other medicines that we should really be thoughtful about, and should we be doing more sort of trials of, as opposed to just forever and ever prescribing?
Yeah, so glucocorticoids are huge. I mean, that's obviously one that anybody who's on a chronic glucocorticoid, you really have to be thinking about, what that's doing to bone mineral density. And you mentioned some of the other ones that are less commonly noted, like SSRIs or, even some anticonvulsants. I think that you need to, if you are putting a patient on those, and especially if it's a woman, because bone, there's two types of cells that make bone and break it down. And so estrogen is important for inhibiting the cells that break down bone. And when you lose that estrogen in a postmenopausal woman, those cells then don't have that stop mechanism. And so they start breaking down bone more rapidly. And so anything that affects sex hormones is also going to have a significant effect. If you have an at-risk person because of one of those modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors, and they're on one of these medications, I think you just need to be thinking about, what is their calcium intake? What's their vitamin D intake? And, it's location dependent. In places where people get a lot of sunshine, you obviously don't have to worry as much about vitamin D. But I did my orthopedic residency in Milwaukee, and we were doing a hospital-wide project looking at all fractures that came into the hospital and their vitamin D levels. And what we found was that everybody was low, even young, healthy men were low. And so the cost of doing the testing didn't make sense anymore. And so we just routinely started putting people on 1,000 IU of vitamin D daily if they'd had a fracture. It's a fairly inexpensive thing to do, well tolerated, low, risk profile. And so, I think that you would consider, adding that to your patient's, regimen if they are high risk and on one of these medications.
So it sounds like you were referring to preventing a secondary fracture once somebody's had one and just going ahead and starting them on the vitamin D. Can we talk about diagnosis of osteopenia and osteoporosis and how you see those two categories differently, perhaps, or the same?
So it's a spectrum, and so there's kind of three categories, because both osteopenia and osteoporosis, you have to be over a certain age, and then there's the third one, which is low bone mineral density for chronologic age, which is when somebody is younger than, I think it's either 60 or 65, or younger than 50 and has a low bone mineral density. The formal diagnosis depends on obtaining a DEXA scan. The DEXA scan looks at a couple of different areas of bone and determines, based on how dense the bone is there against a normal curve, the T score and the Z score. The T score is based off of a standard cohort of health matched, I think, like 30-year-olds. And so you're basing it off of somebody who has their peak bone mineral density. The Z score is matched against people your age with your risk factors. If you have a T score between 1 and 2.5 standard deviations below the mean, then we say that you have osteopenia. If you have risk factors and Z score, I think it's below 2.5. Yeah, 2.5. Then we say that you have osteoporosis. So it's essentially how far are you off from that standard deviation. It's different for women and men, what age we start talking about. And so there are tools which are really useful for this. The one that I've used most commonly is the FRAX, or the FRAX, which will help you figure out whether which category people fall into, and then also help suggest your 10-year risk of having a fracture of any kind, and then also your risk of having a hip fracture. So it can help you with the diagnosis and then also getting into treatment.
Okay. So again, this may be more of a primary care thing than an orthopedic surgeon thing, but you know, there's a diff there are difference in ways that you can scan folks. And so my understanding is that the FRAX is validated specifically regarding axial bone mineral density, so hip and spine, vertebral spine. And then there, you know, I'm wondering as a hand surgeon, as an upper extremity surgeon, is there value added to peripheral measurements of bone density in terms of prevention?
Yeah, my understanding is that there's not that if you have low bone mineral density in the axial spine that peripherally you have the same because the axial spine should be seeing more stress than the
Okay. Thank you. And then can we talk about frequency of screening? It seems to me that this is probably just something that expert opinion just sort of came out with. I'm unaware of any evidence-based, you know, direction on how often should we screen folks with DEXA scans.
Yeah, I think if you have, I did see at some point, if you have somebody that's at risk or you've diagnosed with osteoporosis, that you repeat the screening every 2 years. I think I haven't really seen any like broad consensus about who to indicate for screening, though. I know that if you do have somebody who is, at risk, and getting them on treatment, that there's a significant reduction in overall fractures, and that we're doing a really poor job in this country of identifying those individuals. And so I think that there is a tremendous opportunity, to increase our treatment of these individuals because it's pretty widely undertreated. But I have not come across any like consensus about who we should and should not be treating. And so I think about, women over 65, at-risk men, men who have these other risk factors is who I would consider.
Okay. And then you mentioned that other category of folks who may have some other predisposition to low bone density, and they would have a different diagnosis, but you'd basically be treating them the same because they're basically osteoporotic, but they don't fit the definition because they're too young.
Right, yeah. Or even if it's like a if somebody has multiple risk factors and it's a woman on an aromatase inhibitor and she's 45 and she's been on it for a while and she is a heavy drinker, not very active, she wouldn't fit into that category, but you might say, you've got enough risk factors that it would make sense to let's check her DEXA scan and see how that bone marrow density is doing.
Okay, great. Can we talk about treatment a little bit?
Sure. So I'm definitely, I'll put the disclosure here. I am not the expert in treatment. But I'll get back to the FRAX tool here because I find it to be a very easy to understand one. And it's been well validated, but essentially what it does is it looks at, it combines your age, risk factors, and then your DEXA scan, and creates a prediction for your 10-year risk of having a fracture, and then also it can break it down based on the type of fracture. So, 10-year probability of a hip fracture versus all fractures. Using that tool, you can actually, there are some recommendations for treatment. And so, fairly simple to understand, which was, if you have a 10-year risk greater than 3% of having a hip fracture, or a 10-year risk greater than 20% of having any fracture, a T-score between 1 and 2.5 and a postmenopausal woman greater than 50, then there's definite benefit to pharmacologic treatment. And then there's moderate benefit just in women over 65 and older with a bone mineral density between negative 1 and negative 2.5. The nice thing about that is you only need a couple pieces of information, and it kind of triggers you. As far as what treatment options we have, there's obviously you want to make sure that they're getting appropriate calcium, vitamin D, and then there's two broad categories of medications. So there's the anabolic agents, which are less commonly used, and then there's the anti-resorptive agents, which are the ones that are more commonly used. So those are things like your diphosphonates and your bisphosphonates, and the way that most of those work is by inhibiting osteoclasts. And so those are the cells that break down the bone. Those are the ones that the estrogen normally inhibits, and so it's another way of doing it. Basically, they incorporate into the mineral structure of the bone. So as the osteoclast comes and it tries to take out that mineral, it shuts it down. There's various formulations of those medications. There's both oral medications that you can take monthly, and there's even a medication that you can take once yearly. The big side effects, there's also other versions of those anti-resorptives, such as monoclonal antibodies, that last slightly longer. One of the big issues with the diphosphonates, the thing that I probably hear most that patients are concerned about, are osteonecrosis of the jaw and then atypical femur fractures.
Yeah.
And these are both real concerns because they do happen. I've treated a couple of atypical femur fractures. And so it's not, it does happen. But it happens at a very, very low rate. I mean, it's a 1 in 10,000. And if you get a lot of patients on these medications, then that happens. But the effectiveness of these medications is saving, 100 fractures out of 10,000. And
Right.
so for every 100 fractures, it wouldn't be that high. I mean, some of those numbers come from cancer patients who are on high doses of these medications. And if I found there was a meta-analysis from 2010 where they looked at three large randomized controlled trials, one of which had minimum 10-year follow-up, and their rates of atypical femur fracture were much lower than that. They actually found that, it was not statistically significant, which is more related probably to, the study being somewhat underpowered. But it's the point being, it's at a very low rate, and that, you'll save 100 fractures for every one that you cause. One more thing while we're talking about treatment, just as I'm thinking about it, the other thing you have to be conscious of is the diphosphonates. They cannot be used to anybody with kidney disease, whereas the monoclonal antibodies can, but there's still options available there.
Okay. Thank you for that. So let's say that my patient fractures. What next?
Yeah. So for sure, everybody that I have who has a low energy fracture, and even some people with high energy fractures, I'm starting them on 1,000 IU of vitamin D and calcium. If it's a obvious fragility fracture, either because of the location, the appearance of the bone on X-ray, or the mechanism, so just ground level fall, then that automatically puts them into high risk for having another fracture. And I recommend referral for treatment. So in my practice, that I don't start the treatment. But I think that there's pretty clear evidence that it does not significantly inhibit healing to start treatment with one of these medications. There's some studies that have suggested that maybe bones heal a little bit slower because the osteoclasts are an important part of bone healing. But I think there's enough studies that point to the contrary, and you have the potential in a high-risk individual of preventing a secondary fracture. So I do recommend initiating treatment for anybody that comes in for with a fragility fracture.
So,
So
like, even in the hospital.
yeah, I mean, it doesn't need to be started, within the week. No, probably not, but reasonably starting it over the next, couple of weeks to month, however long it takes to, get them evaluated. I think that it makes sense to do so. And I don't think there would be anything wrong to starting them on treatment early. There's a woman at Harvard who in the hand surgery world has, kind of taken this as her initiative. And she recommends, for these fragility fractures, for us, that would be a distal radius fracture. And, postmenopausal women or men over 65, she's starting everybody on alendronate at 70 milligrams in addition to the calcium and vitamin D, just kind of right away in her practice. And then, communicating and kind of getting things worked up after that.
To play out this scenario, so say I have a patient who is not somebody who is of screening age yet, but they've come
Okay.
with a wrist fracture. I should go ahead and not only start them on calcium and vitamin D, but according to this one surgeon, this would be the time to go ahead and start treating with an anti-resorptive agent like alendronate or something like that to go ahead and secondary fracture. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so for like a postmenopausal woman or a man over 65 who has a low energy distal radius fracture, that's a fragility fracture, and anybody that's had a fragility fracture at a dramatic risk of having a secondary fragility fracture. So even though we don't have the DEXA scan yet, we know from a functional standpoint that their bone was not able to withstand a low energy fall, which is kind of like the practical, way of diagnosing osteopenia or osteoporosis.
Got it. Yeah, I saw this statistic that once you have a fracture, 86% will have a second fracture.
Yep. Yeah. It's crazy.
Okay. So once you've had the fracture, is there a place for, and you're starting somebody on treatment, is there a duration of treatment? Like, say I give somebody RECLASS, which is an every 5 year infusion, is there a role for continuing to measure bone density? And sort of a follow-up question to that is, if I have my own scanner and I'm scanning this patient on my office's scanner, is that an internally valid, if the T-score bounces around up and down, is that significant? Or should I just not be scanning because I've got them on treatment? And should I just treat them for the duration that is sort of safe to do so?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't think that there's a clear answer to that right now. I know that I've seen some recommendations for, repeating the scan every 2 years. I know that, some people advocate for treatment holidays to try and present things like, the osteonecrosis or atypical femur fracture. But I haven't seen any sort of clear consensus on that. And so I think you kind of have to make a decision on a case by case basis. If, somebody's doing well on treatment and they're at high risk and you want to continue treatment, maybe, if they're, really high risk and you're like, they're not going to be, coming back to the normal range, then you just keep treatment going. If it's somebody that was kind of borderline and, you've had time to kind of correct, smoking or alcohol or exercise and some of the things, the modifiable risk factors, and there's a chance that you might be changing the treatment plan, then I think it'd be worth getting this study. With any study, I always think, what is the chance that this is going to change my treatment? Is this just something that I'm reflexively ordering, or am I going to use this information? And I think that if you're in a position where you think, in your clinical judgment, you would find a difference and it would change your plan, then I think it would make sense to do it.
Okay. Yeah. It's funny. I think we think as doctors, we're about, prescribing the medicine or ordering the test. But it sounds like with this particular entity, it's so much about lifestyle, and that if we can, maybe if we can use our tests as a way of encouraging or better lifestyle, then that's kind of our edge.
As far as the duration of treatment, I think that if somebody's really high risk, a hip fracture carries a depending on the study that you read, a 20 to 40% mortality rate. I mean, it's these are fractures that are associated with pretty severe morbidity. And
Absolutely.
so the 1 in 10,000 chance, or lower, what it might be of having a complication, to me seems well worth the risk. When I get to kind of see these patients that they have one of these fragility fractures, and it puts them in the hospital for 3 months or however long. And I'm sure you see this in the palliative side of patients who are dealing with fragility fractures in their spine or their hip. It's not a, while as a hand surgeon, mostly I'm seeing the distal radius fractures, the distal radius fracture is usually the harbinger of the hip fracture to come, which is a much bigger deal.
Absolutely. I guess to finish off, any last, pointers that you want to give us, as well as, is there, when should we be referring to you?
So, referral to me comes after they've fractured. The, we're not really set up for medication management and prevention. But I do think that after patients have fractured, it does take a multidisciplinary approach to best treat them going forward. The surgical treatment or non-surgical treatment, medication management, I think that as an orthopedic surgeon, I have a big role in getting people to treatment, because by the time they've gotten to me, they've basically screened for having osteoporosis or osteopenia. And so it's something that I'm working on, is trying to make sure that they then get hooked up with care after the fact. I think it's about keeping open lines of communication too, and getting multiple providers involved to make sure that we get this better treated for these patients.
Okay. Thank you so much. I've learned a lot, and I hope that this is a topic that others are appreciative of as well. So, thank you again so much for sharing your expertise, and I hope not to send folks to you, but I'm glad you're here in Asheville.
Yeah, thank you. And I do have one statistic I'd like to kind of throw it out as we close here. That same NEJM paper from 2010, they had mentioned in there that if you start patients on these anti-resorptive medications, you treat 1,000 patients and you save 100 fractures. When you compare that to a statin, for statins, you treat 1,000 patients and you save 18, myocardial infarctions. And so the number needed to treat is extremely low compared to some of the other medications that we prescribe very routinely. And a hip fracture is not an MI, but it is a morbid thing. And I think that we have a tremendous opportunity here to improve our coverage of these patients and prevent fractures.
Absolutely. Thank you for highlighting that. That is exactly the kind of statistic that we need to think about. How much we can benefit with our treatment, and the fact just how powerful these medicines are, and how morbid these fractures are. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Caroline.